Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'm delighted to be here. Let me get my... I still don't know what happened to the title. Something weird. Big blank up there.
Bill Gates didn't like the title. Talk about
transparency. Yeah, pattern formation with a zooplankton experiment in theory, if I recall it correctly. And yeah, so this is the work of Anke Ordemann, who was a Fyodor Lenin postdoc in our center a year or so ago. And the theory is, I'm only going to summarize this quite briefly, is by this group at Humboldt University in Berlin, whom we've been working with. And our support is Office of Naval Research and from the Alexander Humboldt Foundation. And the motivation for this work is shown in this slide. Yeah, if I can get it going. And this is, we copied this from Discovery. This is a school of anchovies, and they're being attacked by some tuna fish that want to eat them, and their response is to form this kind of a biological hydrodynamic vortex that involves fluid motion as well as animal motion. And it turns out that a lot of living creatures form such things. Birds do it, and bees do it, and fleas do it. You'll see in this... Fleas do it. So we'd like to understand a little bit about how that comes about. Probably it arises from different mechanisms with different animals, but I'll tell you about our little animal. So, and this is actually, this work is somewhat of a departure from what I used to do, which was more work on sensory biology, but this is, was inspired by this theory that people developed in Humboldt University, active Brownian particle theory, they call it. And it was originated by Werner Ebeling in about 1995 or so. And so I'm going to outline that very briefly, and then I'm going to talk about the bifurcations that that theory predicts, and then I'll introduce you to our little animal. It's a water flea, and show our experiment. I had the idea that we could actually test this, at least the motions predicted by this theory, using this animal. And until a few years ago, the only use we ever had of this this Daphnia, this is a water flea, it's about a millimeter long or so, is we were feeding them to our passively electric fish. And so they were just fish food, the only reason we were breeding them. But I came back from Berlin 2 years ago and got interested in them for their own sake. And I'll talk to you about a random walk theory that we have, and then how this vortex motion comes about and how it arises out of individual motions of the individual animals. And then I'll show you some more simulations. Okay, so active Brownian particle theory. The idea is a particle moves in a two-dimensional medium, and it takes up energy. And of course, it can take up more energy if it moves over a greater area. So that's the biological motivation. It's like a foraging animal that can feed. And of course, to move through this medium, it dissipates energy as well, so there's a viscous contribution. And this is a Langevin equation. It has a noise term in it, and it has a central potential and a velocity-dependent dissipation. And this is Werner Ebeling's model. He calls it the energy depot model. Energy is stored in this depot and then is drained from the depot at a constant rate by the animal's metabolism, and then by a variable rate that depends on how rapidly it moves through the medium in its search for more energy. So... the origin of the noise term, we just stick it there because it could be turbulence, it could be anything. It's because when we observe this motion in real life, it's always noisy. Sorry. So there's a noise term. Actually, the detailed origin of the fluctuations that we really observe in the experiment are for surely, it, to some degree, hydrodynamic, and the rest, I don't know. They may just be...
You don't have hydrodynamics here.
Well, not yet, no.
The little creek is swimming in water, so...
Yeah.
Hydrodynamics involved.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
There's no hydrodynamics here, no. Except the velocity-dependent dissipation. That's not what you would call hydrodynamics. So, and then there's a second equation that governs the time evolution of the energy stored in this depot. And this Q term can be variable over the two-dimensional plane. We're going to simplify things by making it a uniform distribution. This is the distribution of energy over the plane that is available to the animal. This is the constant rate of loss of energy due to the animal's metabolism. And this is the energy expended in motion. And it's, of course, proportional to the square of the velocity. And several assumptions are made to simplify things here, the chief one being an adiabatic elimination of this of the time dependence. That is, the assumption is that this energy uptake will be slow compared to other times in the problem, other characteristic times. And one arrives at this expression for a velocity-dependent dissipation. And there's a constant term, and then there's a term that depends on the square of the velocity. And we need to look at these other constants. D2 is the sort of strength of the energy uptake due to motion. C is the strength of the energy drain due to metabolism. And Q is the availability of energy in the medium. And so this velocity-dependent dissipation has as a function of velocity, looks like this. So there's a region of velocity where there is energy pumping into the system, and a region of velocity where there's dissipation. And so what happens in equilibrium, we arrive at a constant velocity. This is the self-propelling velocity of the animal. And this is where this theory touches other theories that have been developed to try to explain the motions of these animals. So we have a constant velocity. And of course, with the noise term, there will be fluctuations around that. And what's interesting is that this theory results in a bifurcation. And there's a very nice bifurcation parameter that just is some ratios of these constant terms that I had there before. And if this bifurcation parameter is smaller than zero, then the motion is a noisy fixed point about the center of the central potential. And if it's greater than zero, there is a limit cycle. This is a spatial limit cycle. This is in the two-dimensional plane of motion. And this limit cycle, actually there are two limit cycles, depending on initial conditions, which way they would start. Some go clockwise and some go counterclockwise. And these are two completely symmetric solutions. So both motions are available. And when I got back to St. Louis after hearing these people talk about this, I happened to walk into the lab one night at 2 o'clock in the morning, and David Russell was in there, and the lights were all on, and we looked in an aquarium with our Daphne in it that we were breeding for the fish food, and we saw this interesting kind of structure. The individual animals are making a rotational motion around the core of this, and for all the world, this looks like a vortex line.
They're underwater.
Sorry? Oh yeah, this is taken in through the side of a three-dimensional aquarium. And we're looking at a side view. If we look down, you'll see top views a little later in my talk and bottom views. But the individual animals are moving in rotational motion about the core of this.
What's the horizontal line?
Where? This?
No, the purple one.
The horizontal line.
Oh, that, okay. It's an artifact completely.
Okay.
Behind the aquarium, we had been trying to photograph these just to get a swarm. And behind the aquarium, we had two pieces of white cardboard. And one piece of white cardboard wasn't big enough to cover the whole aquarium, so a second piece of white cardboard was put on top of it, and that's what the line is.
Can I say that limit cycle was a single one?
The limit cycle you saw was a single trajectory. Yeah,
so
starting those equations.
Why does it change why don't you get a solution of just a constant velocity for those equations moving in some, why does it go in a circle as opposed to?
We have a central potential now.
Oh, central. You have a central potential.
Yeah, it's the circular motion depends on that central potential.
Fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the basis of including a central potential?
What is the?
I mean, why do you have a central potential?
I hope I can answer that a little later. If you have an attractive, a long-range attractive interaction between the animals or the particles, then you can do a mean field, and that will result in a central potential. But I'm starting really simply. And in our experiment, we don't need a mean field. We don't need a mean field, and we don't need an attractive interaction between our animals. As you'll see in a minute, we impose a central potential on it by putting a marker that they are attracted to.
So what are these particular animals going to? Is a food in the middle or something?
I'm going to have to walk up to you. I have a little trouble hearing.
I'm sorry. What are these particular animals?
They are Daphnia magna.
No. Why are they going to the middle? Like, are they
I do not know why they're going. I wish I did know. Something goes on in their brain that makes them do that. No, actually, your question is very interesting. This structure we observed by accident, never expecting to see anything like that. Normally, we don't ever see that, anything like that. And if you turn the lights off, it has something to do with light. If you turn the lights off, within 15 minutes, they will more or less evenly distribute themselves throughout the aquarium. And in fact, I performed a little experiment with this by simply moving this cardboard structure slightly in the back, just by about a couple of inches, to expose this right-hand edge not to have the white background. And this structure dissipated within about 5 minutes, and then pushed the cardboard back and it reformed in about another 10. I have no idea why. Nobody knows why exactly. Okay, so this is the animal you asked, Daphnia magna. It's one of the many species of these things. They're about a half to 1.5 millimeters in length, and they're just a little creature. It swims through the water by flailing these antennae, and it has some other appendages that operate here that help it feed. This one happens to be pregnant. It's about ready to give birth, live birth. This is the baby getting ready to come out of a birth canal, but that's rather irrelevant to this talk. Now I want to show you what these things look like when they move through the water. And so this is a movie. See, here's the little guy going. This is a movie that was made for us by Rudy Strickler, some of his people, Naomi, in fact, at the Great Lakes Water Institute. Let's start it again. A couple of things. First of all, notice that it moves by discrete hops. This is a Schlieren photograph through the water, so you can see the wake behind this animal.
Was that real time?
Yeah. Yeah, real time. And the other thing that will be important in this talk in a minute that I'd like for you to notice is that at the end of every hop, this animal changes direction slightly. And we will have occasion to measure that and then make use of it. Okay, so about Daphnia, it's a common water flea. And they have three major characteristics that we have used. First of all, they are attracted to visible light. Second, they're repelled by ultraviolet. That's not used in this experiment, but nevertheless they are. In other experiments we have, we're working with that. And they're blind to infrared. And so what we can do, we can photograph their motion or videotape their motion in infrared without affecting the motion, and then we can manipulate their motion with visible light. So coming back from Berlin, I had the idea to, because they're attracted to visible light, to make a central, something that mimicked the central potential in Aveling's theory, by making a light shaft, producing a light shaft that went down through an aquarium vertically like that. And we have a kind of shallow aquarium, so we have not really two-dimensional motion, but something, I don't know what, approximating that. And we have here a filter to block infrared from the light source, a 45-degree mirror, cameras that look into the aquarium, both the side view and the bottom view, and appropriate filters to block visible and UV and allow the infrared through. So we have here infrared illuminators that make the Daphnia visible and the visible light shaft that they respond to. Okay, and now we're looking at a bottom view through that 45-degree mirror. On the left, there's about 40 animals in this clip. And what you'll see is that they're circling around this light shaft. When we turn the light on, after I start the movie, these, by the way, are the individual Daphnia, these little white dots. And when we turn the light on, you'll see first they are startled by it and they rush away from it. But quite soon, they turn around and are attracted toward the light. And this movie is speeded up about four times. The radius, to give you an idea of the dimension of this, the radius is about 5 millimeters of this light shaft. You can't see it. I can see it. It's a little black dot there. When the light goes on, you'll see it. We have a little disc that masks it to keep it from swamping the cameras. Okay, so here's the motion. Okay, there's the light on, and you notice that they flee away first, and then quite rapidly they start coming back in, and to your eye their motion more or less looks just random, but if you do concentrate on any one of them, you'll see that on average they are making rotational motions around this light shaft. They are moving around it. Sorry?
Like in the visible light, do the bugs see each other?
That's also a good question. They have an eye. That big black dot that I showed in the picture is the Daphnia's eye, but biologists do not believe that they can form an image with that. It's a rather simple eye. And it's known to respond to direction of light and also even polarization of light and, of course, wavelength. But it's not clear that they can form an image. So they may be able to see other Daphnia at a distance if there are huge numbers of them by the shadow, but they may not be able to see neighbors. I don't know. Okay, so in the right-hand panel is the way we can analyze data like that. These are five successive snapshot pictures taken at 3/10 second intervals with black and white inverted. So the dark dot is the first snapshot and the light dot is the last snapshot. So each one of these traces of five dots is the trace of a single Daphnia moving with 3/10 of a second between each snapshot picture. So you can see that this one, for example, here's the beginning motion and here's the end. So this one is moving in a clockwise direction, and you can find others that are moving counterclockwise, and there are approximately equal numbers moving in either direction. And we also can get the velocity from data like that. And I want to show you also a more detailed motion of, here's a single individual Daphnia. Admittedly, this is kind of a rare thing, but we're going to find out that this single Daphnia spends a lot of time circling around this light shaft. Okay, this is the guy to watch, this one right here. Yeah, so he's moving around a little bit, but pretty soon he gets his act together and follows around and around and around and around and more and more and more. And yeah. So he's going to change direction toward the end of this movie clip. He changes direction. It'll happen right up around here. Yeah. That was one single loop, but that wasn't it. And yeah, here he is. And now he goes in the other direction. He gets in the mode of he switched to the other limit cycle. And this is a track of that single Daphnia, and it. For a total of a sort of 146 seconds, it makes this circular motion. And here's the loop where it changed direction and went the other direction. So single daphnia circle individually in both directions around the light shaft, and they change their direction of motion frequently. And so how to characterize this circular motion or this rotational motion? Of course, you have to do it statistically because everything's very noisy and random. So we have analyzed here 624 moves from four different animals. And as I showed you in the previous, in one of the previous clips of the hopping and the the 3/10 of a second snapshot pictures, we can get a pretty good measure of their velocity. This is the self-propelling velocity of our daphnia. And it's surprisingly constant for all animals. It's around 5 or 6, plus or minus 1, something like that for all animals. And now the geometry that I want to point out to you here mentioned defines an angle called theta. This is the, we're going to call the heading angle. And this is a vector in space, although it's labeled time here. This is one hop from one position in space, from one hop. This represents one hop. This is the beginning of the hop, and this is the end of it. And we connect those two points with a vector and draw a radius to the center of the light shaft, and that angle is the angle theta. So obviously, if theta plus and minus 90 degrees represents rotational motion around the light shaft. So here's a histogram of our 624 moves, and you can see that there are large bars at plus and minus 90 degrees, and within some error or statistical precision, they seem to be more or less equally probable. We can also get for these moves, we can get a histogram of the radii out from the center of the light shaft, and so we know that the radius is approximately 15 millimeters out for these conditions. And another interesting number is the number of successive hops before changing direction, that is from counterclockwise to clockwise. And you might also wonder, with a sort of random velocity vector, what do we define? How do we define in a given hop, clockwise or counterclockwise? The answer is, if there is any component of this vector, any component that is pointed in the direction perpendicular to the radius, if it's positive, it's counterclockwise, and if it's negative, it's clockwise. So a histogram of the number of hops before changing direction is some kind of thing that looks like this. And you'll see that the most often changes of direction occur after 4, 5, or 6 hops, something like that. In fact, the mean of this is 11.8. So after 11.8 hops is the average change of direction. But there are some animals that, like the one that I showed in that previous clip, that execute many, many, many hops in the same rotational direction before changing.
The daphnia,
I could go back to the previous film clip. The daphnia move by hops. They beat those antenna and move forward in a hop and then pause. And then beat again, move forward and pause.
How many hops will go around?
I don't know. I have to calculate that. Yeah, I don't know how to answer that. The radius of the light beam is 5 millimeters. It's in these experiments, the light was actually confined to a cylindrical lucite tube, and we were in some kind of an effort to make a radial distribution of light, and that was 5 millimeters in diameter.
Are the number of daphnia in each of those experiments the same? It's like 40, like the one you showed.
Or 40? Okay, 40. I know what you're thinking.
The question is, if you go to large enough, do they then tend to lock in for longer periods of time?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we're going to see that in a minute. Okay. These we believe, analyzed based on our looking at all these motions, that there are practically no interactions from daphnia to daphnia at these low densities when there's only like 40 or 50 in the aquarium. Okay, I'm going to run out of time if I don't hurry. Just to point out one thing, we needed to analyze the motion of daphnia naturally in the dark without stimulus. And this is a here we've analyzed about 1,600 moves from 8 different animals. And here's an example of one. This is a track composed of 200 hops and in XY, and you can see that this Daphne is going somewhere. It's not just making a random motion on the plane. And so that means that there's a correlation from hop to hop to hop of its direction. And we have measured that. That's a different angle that we call the distribution of turning angles. At the end of every hop, the animal turns slightly and before the next hop, and the mean of that distribution is something like about 35 degrees. We measured this for the first time for freshwater plankton, and it's very similar. Such a measurement has been made once before for oceanic copepods, and it's the same number, almost the same number, about 32 degrees or so. So that's probably something to do with evolution. At the end of every hop, the animal turns. That must optimize something having to do with its survival. Okay, I'm going to run out of time. So we have a random walk simulation that shows these two. This is the distribution of heading angles, and the plus and minus 90, of course, show rotational motion. This is the probability of radius. And if you want to look at our experimental data, whoa, go back one. Our experimental data, just for comparison, look like this. Here's the distribution of radii, and here's the distribution of heading angles. I don't have time to talk about these. This is the really the number of hops before changing direction. This is the random walk simulation, and this is the experimental data. Once again, we do not explain this kind of like long tail out here in this distribution. Many particle generalizations. Maybe I should just really rush. In many particles without interaction, without short range, well, switching on long range interactions but without short range repulsion, there still are these two symmetric limit cycles. And so you end up getting distributions. These happen to be velocity distributions like this. And another person who has looked at this very same kind of dynamical phenomena is Herbie, who wrote down something like this. And he has a velocity aligning mechanism that has to do with a self-propelling force rather than self-propelling velocity that we have. But he gets exactly the same kind of results for no short-range repulsion, I believe, but only a long-range attraction. Again, you have more or less equal numbers of particles traveling in opposite directions. Now I want to show you that we can observe, okay, so, yeah. So now what happens when the Daphnia density becomes very, very large? Something happens at short range to break the symmetry of these two limit cycles. And so one is favored over the other, and quite soon, all the motion becomes in the same direction. And now I'm going to show you that happening. This happens to be counterclockwise. I'd like to tell you that the water is moving and the animals are moving. Both are moving. This also even forms spiral arms, if you'll notice, which are really kind of interesting. And these, notice that there are a few particles here on the surface of the water that are trapped in the surface tension, and they decorate the motion of the water. Let's look at that again.
So the water is rotating with the same direction as the animals.
What determines the original direction?
So the water is rotating in the same direction as the animals.
Yes. Yes. The animals are moving counterclockwise, and the water's motion is by these particles on the surface tension are moving in the same direction. Yeah. The Daphnia in the dark uniformly distribute themselves more or less in the aquarium. And we have to prepare by leaving the aquarium in the dark for something like about 30 minutes before switching any light on. Then if you switch a light on from above, it can even be large diameter, the first thing that happens is they swarm in from all the parts of the aquarium toward the center of the light beam. And the second thing that happens after a period of time is this rotational motion.
And in that picture, where's the light beam?
It's coming from the top down onto, this photograph is made onto the top of the aquarium, and
where
it's coming
it
down. Sorry?
Where is it centered? Can you point to the center?
Can I point to it? Not precisely. Probably around here somewhere. Okay, one more picture. This is just shows up.
So, if constant illumination isn't good enough, you still need a core of a light beam?
Yes. Yeah. This is another one that shows first the light switched on and the swarming take place. And this one shows a thing that we find very interesting, that it takes a long time. In this case, it takes a long time for this vortex to form. We can watch this. If you can follow the individual motion, which is very difficult, of any one daphnia, again, you will find that it's executing some kind of rotational motion around whatever is the center of this light beam. But it takes a long time for this to develop into this rotational motion. It's going to happen after a while.
Was your graduate student drunk?
Why is this all jittering all around? That's actually a good question. I don't believe so, but I don't really know. This could be done a lot better, I agree. So pretty soon you'll see, again, you see these few trapped in the surface that begin to make, there you see the water begin to rotate. Okay, and so I'm not going to bore you with it. We have a simulation that also shows that based on a kind of local order parameter in a certain little neighborhood. This is just a velocity aligning mechanism, something we just cooked up. And then there's a global order parameter, and we can watch. It has to do with the number, the total number going clockwise minus counterclockwise, and how it evolves in time. And so this jitters around for a while, and then suddenly the rotational motion sets in. And so I'm finished, I guess. Yeah. What are the conclusions? The theory predicts four motions: noisy fixed point, symmetric pair of limit cycles, swarming, and transition to vortex. And we can see all of those in our Daphne experiment. Yeah.
You started out with this picture of fish from the Discovery Channel, which I realize that's not what you studied. But my understanding is scuba divers often have observed these motions. And in the case of fish, they're driven by predators. I mean, the predators will circle.
Yeah.
Will circle and compact the bait ball and then go straight through. I've actually tried it myself. I was far too slow. The fish ignored me. They will circle around. They will circle around it and compact the bait ball and get it going, but there's sort of nothing like that in this case. So which leads me to sort of be puzzled. In the natural phenomena in nature, Daphne out in the wild, are there things that do this? Is this known?
The answer is yes. We traveled, but they are very, very rarely seen. We traveled to Plern, and it's an institute in Germany run by a person named Wilfried Lampert,
yeah,
who's the world's Daphne expert. And both Anki and I made separate trips there, and with a long list of questions for him. And one was exactly that one: do you ever see this vortex motion in the wild? And he said, in all my field observations, I have seen it only once, and he doesn't know why it happens. It may have something to do with predators. The predator of these Daphne are visually hunting fish, unless our paddlefish are down on the bottom of the pond, and then they get them. The answer to your question is rather long and detailed, and we could have a discussion about it afterwards.
Okay, but that could provide the potential, of course. I mean, if they're being pushed in from the outside, I mean, killer whales do this. So they'll circle around and squeeze the bait ball.
I don't think that happens here.
The
marker is light.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm saying in the natural setting, it might be.
That's what I mean.
Yep.
Even in the natural setting, the marker seems to be light. According to Lampert,
oh, really?
There's a white rock or something down at the bottom. One thing we do notice is that it's much easier to form these vortices. It's not clear how they are formed even in the lab. We can make them happen only 50% of the time, and we don't know what makes them happen and what doesn't. Light is always necessary. They seem to form a little bit more easily if we have what are called fish pheromones in the water. That means the smell of fish, which are their predator. If we put that in the water, they form more readily. So it might be related to predators.
But it seems like yeah. Suicide could do it. That's what's curious.
Yeah.
Because if they, like, you know, that's a nice big mouthful. If they
yeah.
On some level, they must communicate, or you'd probably never get more daphnia. And if you... So it might be very short-range communication. On the other hand, if you could exploit that, or maybe find what pheromones they secrete or whatever to make communication possible, then you might get more complex behavior, or it might be part of why they do or don't transition to formation.
When conditions are good, they don't have to communicate to breed. They have a very, these daphnia have a very complex behavior all of their own. Basically, the short answer is when conditions are good, that means when there's not very many predators and there's plenty of food and the temperature is right, they breed clonally. And that one daphnia that I showed with the baby is about ready. That baby is a total genetic clone of the mother. And so they all are females. But when some toxin invades the lake and conditions become bad, suddenly they start breeding males, and then they breed sexually. And it all has to do with, I'm not an evolutionist, but probably these guys are in total equilibrium with Darwinian evolution. They've been around for 450 million years, and they've solved every problem there ever is. And so probably they have found that when conditions are good, genetic stasis is a survival mechanism. And when conditions are not good, then they need genetic variability in order to somehow have a few survive. And so that's another, I'm sorry, I probably didn't answer your question at all.
Yeah, I have a question about how ripe is this field for relating model and experiment. So in the model, you have a version of the model where you don't put the central vortex with the central light, but the velocity of motion depends on some average of the
yeah.
what some neighbors are doing, sort of like what Herbie put in his model. And then in this case, you don't put in by hand the vortex. It's sort of the symmetry has to be broken. Right?
In the model, there are two things that we are looking at. One is hydrodynamic coupling, because mm-hmm. the animals themselves are covered with mechanoreceptors. Mm-hmm. So for sure, they can detect water motions from a neighbor, at least some, sure. I don't know how far away, mm-hmm. but within some range. So in the model, the Humboldt people have put in an austene flow, a kind of a dipolar fluid mm-hmm. flow around a sphere moving, and then computed the components of velocity of that at a distance. And then they add that velocity to the neighbor. And this is the velocity aligning mechanism that breaks the symmetry and causes the vortex to form.
Wait, okay, I understand. Potential.
No, not anymore.
Now we don't have a central potential. We have a short range repulsion and a long range attraction and a mean field, maybe.
Okay, so let me just elaborate on the question. So you put hydrodynamic interactions. If you only put hydrodynamic interaction, then the model should predict that should get the swirling without the light on or with the light on.
No light. No light.
With no light. Yeah. Yeah, but I understood from the experiments, however, that it's only when you turn the light, even homogeneously, that you get the swirling. So my question is, can you go back and do a type of experiments where you look maybe at a group of 10 or maybe 2, 3, and try to get the two-body interaction, three-body, and see how different it is with and without the light in terms of, you know, non-hydrodynamic communications?
That's absolutely. All those experiments remain to be done.
Okay.
I can assure you no vortex will ever happen unless the density is something like what you saw, millions per liter.
Okay.
And whether we could make a vortex in the dark with that high a density or not, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
It's hard enough to make it just with light. Sometimes okay. they happen, sometimes they don't.
Sort of a complimentary question. If there is an interaction through them seeing the light scattered, for instance, from the other daphnia, would you be able to, do you ever see vortices if you uniformly illuminate so that you're turning on that optical interaction as opposed to a light column?
I can only say probably. The first vortex we ever saw in the lab was that one that I showed the photograph of. The second we ever saw is Anke just by accident found a particular place on the floor of the lab if she put the aquarium that and left the lab lights on, fluorescent lights up there, they would form, this vortex would form, a vortex would form. And we have, it's very complicated what actually triggers this vortex. The light shaft is one thing that will do it, but not even that, not with 100% success. And it's a mystery how it happens.
Have you ever tried to create more than one vortex? Have you ever tried to create more than one vortex and to see how they interact?
Yes, we have, and I can only answer anecdotally. Yes, in the aquaria, if you stir and make a vortex, then they tend to keep it going, or they try to keep it going sometimes. Yes, they feel water motion, they feel flow, and they have a tendency to line up with each other and follow the flow.
With no light.
Yeah, with no light.
So they like to swim against the stream, basically? Is that what breaks the symmetry? Well, how could that be? I mean, there's conservation of angular momentum, you know? The water can't spiral around the same...
No, we thought a lot about that. I don't know how that works either. When the first Daphnia... Look, first of all, there are equal numbers moving clockwise as counterclockwise.
When the density gets high.
Then a few start going in one direction, and as they beat their little antenna, the water obviously goes behind them. But remember, it's very, very low Reynolds number. This is extremely low Reynolds number. So that water that's going behind them is damped out right away, and they're moving forward, and they're dragging the water with them. I mean, it's a detailed problem that's kind of complicated. I don't know how to attack it. Yeah.
Let's thank the speaker.
Thank you.